Oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the State of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the Court has three clauses on its oral submission docket. In the order of the presentation, they are Valley Total Fitness Corporation versus Keith Jackson individually and on behalf of others, and Freddie Mac from Bexar County. American Home Products Corporation and Wisehurst Laboratory versus Fawn C. Clark and others from Johnson County, and Ray E. Gilbert Jr. and others versus El Paso County Hospital District and others from El Paso County. In each of these matters, the Court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshals of our court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and will conclude these arguments before our noon break. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of our court, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. Justice Owen is not here today, but she will participate in the deliberation and decision in these causes. The Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Valley versus Jackson.
May it please the Court, Mr. Lawrence Tribe will be presenting argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'd like, if I may, to discuss three things this morning. First, how proceeding by the method of judgment first, notice to follow, transformed the class in this case even more fundamentally than changing the class from opt-out to mandatory transformed the class in De Los Santos.
So you'd agree that we have to find a fundamental change in the class?
Yes, Justice O'Neill, I do agree.
Presume that we find that there's been an improper one-way intervention. And I understand there's some dispute about that. But presume that is the case. How has the fundamental nature of the class been affected?
In several ways, Justice Owen. It's been transformed because it's been converted from a real class authorized by Rule 42b-4 to a spurious class outlawed by Rule 42 ever since 1977. And it's indeed illegitimate at birth in the sense that its creation violated Rule 42C 1, 2, and 3. Beyond that, it's been converted from a class awaiting formal notice and an opportunity to choose whether to stay in or opt out.
But it's still an opt-out class.
Oh, it's an opt-out class, but the fundamental difference is that whereas before it was waiting to make that decision unpolluted by some irreversible knowledge, now it is impossible for it to receive notice untainted by the indelible fact.
Why does that change? It's still an opt-out class. How is the nature of the class affected?
Justice O'Neill, I suppose if the only thing that bore on the nature of the class was where in several little boxes within Rule 42B one puts something, that would be a rather mechanical rule. In fact, if something moves out of the box altogether from Rule 42 to an outlaw class, a class in which any notice that it received will be irretrievably tainted.
Well, let me just ask you about that real quick, mm-hmm. because the notice in this case doesn't say that partial summary judgment has been granted, does it?
No, the notice itself is in that sense misleading, but we think that it is unrealistic to suppose that people out there, after this has been on television and after it's been public, can be assumed not to have known about it. This court, after all, did say that class actions are not an exception to the normal universe. There's no alternative universe for class actions. There's also no alternative cosmology. Time only moves forward. You can't unwind the clock and pretend that there wasn't a summary judgment. There's no alternative cognitive psychology. That is, it's awfully hard voluntarily to forget something that you know.
But don't you have to look beyond and look at the specifics of the order that was entered in this case? This is an interlocutory partial summary judgment motion that was granted.
Interlocutory, certainly, in the sense that we couldn't appeal it because damages hadn't been awarded.
And interlocutory in the sense that the trial judge could also withdraw the order at any time or modify it.
That's always true. It is always true that an order, it could be reversed on appeal, but in every...
And similarly, it did not dispose of the liability issues in any kind of a final way, well, because didn't Valley have affirmative defenses that
no.
were also at issue and had not been disposed of?
Justice Hankinson, with all due respect, the answer to that is no. The
so
only possible affirmative defense was the one it had separately against Jackson, not applicable to the class, namely that he had already been paid. And it was recognized, and is law of the case here, recognized in the 1996 decision upholding the class certification, that the issue on liability common to the whole class was whether these monthly charges constituted finance charges, these monthly fees. If they did, that really ends the case, and indeed it was written in that opinion by the Fourth Court of Appeal that all that would be left is to calculate damages. So that it is interlocutory, but it disposes of the fundamental liability issue in the case.
Okay, but here's the issue with regard to her question, and that is your argument totally gutted if the trial court decides to withdraw its summary judgment?
No, because...
Well, your argument is premised upon the fact that this summary judgment has been granted. The trial court obviously has the ability, if it so desires, to withdraw the summary judgment. If it does so, what leg does your argument have to stand
well,
on?
Justice Abbott, there are at least 90 cases, state and federal, in which that could have been said, because a summary judgment can theoretically be withdrawn. But if it is withdrawn simply pursuant to the suggested remedy of the respondents, namely, let's keep the class going, but reverse the summary judgment, that doesn't change the fact that everyone knows that this judge has solemnly found, as a matter of law, that these monthly charges in these circumstances constitute a finance charge. And once the fact that this judge has made that determination of law, it's not as though he's going to hear some new witnesses, that determination of law, once that fact is publicized, you can't unring the bell or put the cat back in the bag.
What would be the difference in between that scenario and the scenario where you have John Doe file a lawsuit in this particular court, get a partial summary judgment in his favor, and then Jane Doe and 400,000 of her best friends file a class action in that same court on the same subject matter, where they've already known that the same judge has rendered a ruling in their favor on the substance, and now they file this class action, they go about, set out the notice, and then they get their summary judgment.
Well, Justice Abbott, let me first make one thing clear so I understand your question. I'm assuming that despite non-mutual collateral estoppel, that your assumption is that under Cisco Food Services in this court or Park Lane Hosiery in the U.S. Supreme Court, that they would not be able to use offensive collateral estoppel and in effect be ducks pecking the guy to death.
That's all from my point. My point is you seem to be resting your argument on the fact that, well, the whole world knows that this has been determined. I just gave you a different fact situation where the whole world of potential class members can know how the judge is going to rule, how the judge is predisposed on the substance of this particular case before the class action is
right.
even filed.
Just as I think the important point that I want to make is that I'm referring to the knowledge of the members of the class only in the context of answering Justice O'Neill's question about how this class differs from another class.
Can I follow
well,
up on that?
Certainly, but if I just finish the answers to the bit. The fundamental difference between the two situations you posit is that we all have crystal balls. Some are more cracked than others. We all think we know various things about what other people or judges will do. We're often surprised or disappointed. But when you have a class in which one side is bound by the result, and the other side, because it hasn't been noticed, hasn't received notice, is not bound, that fundamental structural asymmetry is awfully fundamental and important. And if it were not, then one would wonder why so much sweat and time and tears and money went in to investigating and changing the federal rules in 66, the Texas rules in 77. It was a very fundamental change. One-way intervention, if I take the drift of some of these questions, is just no big deal. And I'm afraid that under the law of Texas and the federal system, it's quite a big deal.
Well, I mean, again, presume it's a big deal and presume big harm to Valley. But how does it fundamentally affect the nature of the class? I'm having a hard time.
It makes it a lawless class, an outlaw class. It's as though you're asking me, Justice O'Neill, it's a fundamental change to move someone from embezzlement to larceny, but to move him from jail to the free world, that's no big deal. The fundamental difference is that this takes it outside the entire ambit of Rule 42, which was deliberately changed in 1977 to prevent this precise kind of activity. It also changes it from a class that serves the normal, legitimate purposes of adjudication to one whose only purpose is what this court condemned in Infratex.
But it still seems like you're saying because Valley's harmed, the nature of the class has been fundamentally changed.
No, I'm sorry, Justice O'Neill. It is vastly more than just harmed Valley. It's because of the law. We've moved from a legal to an illegal class. We've moved from a class that can get untainted notice to one that can't. We've moved from a class that can make an unfettered choice to one that can't. And it's not just harm to Valley. It is a fundamental violation of the due process rights under the federal and state constitutions of the absent members of the class to treat them as bound.
But Professor Tribe, the issue that we're presented with here is actually interpreting the legislature's enactment to the extent that it is granted an interlocutory appeal from an order certifying or refusing to certify a class. All of the things that you complain about may in fact be appealable and may be grounds for action by an appellate court, but the appellate court must first have jurisdiction. So if we look back at the statute and we look at this particular case, we do have a certification order that was appealed and upheld on appeal. In this case, isn't that the history of
the
case?
Yes, that's certainly right, Justice Hankinson. But under that theory...
Take us back to the statute. Absent De Los Santos, you wouldn't be here arguing at all.
Right, but De Los Santos is here.
I understand, but...
And under the statute literally read, De Los Santos would have to be overruled. It seems to me that De Los Santos recognized the legislature's purpose in creating interlocutory review for decisions bearing profoundly on certification.
But couldn't we limit De Los Santos to its facts?
Into a chemical explosion? To its facts in what way?
To the facts that
not and be a court. That is, not and have reasons that make sense to an audience of Texans.
But that was a totally different case. It
was a weaker case, Your Honor.
Well, you ended up with a crammed-down settlement that the plaintiff class that had opted out would be deprived of their day in court, and it was a fundamental change in the nature of the class.
And here, Your Honor, with all respect, it's crammed down in the sense that all of these people, all members of this class, are denied their day in court, in the sense that they are all bound now, unless this court decertifies and limits the summary judgment to the parties, bound by an adjudication, entered in a proceeding in which they had no notice and
no
hearing.
But they can still opt out.
But the U.S. Supreme Court, in Phillips v. Schatz and in other cases, has made it pretty clear that the fact that at the tail end you could opt out is no substitute for the fact that ex ante you have a right to take part in a proceeding that decides your rights.
Mr. Tribe, let me ask you a question on this. Class was certified, that was affirmed, all that was left was for notice to go out. The argument has been made by the Jackson folks that Valley itself took all the actions or much of the action to prevent the notice from ever going out through the delay of the number of years that occurred. Finally, the trial court goes ahead and starts rendering decisions on some of the merits, and now Valley is here arguing, oh, gee, gosh whiz, the judge is somehow in great error for having ruled on the merits. The argument is that the failure of the notice to go out was not an effort on the part of any of the parties to get a decision before they decided the class. The class was already decided. It was just a fact that there was always some delay in allowing the notice to go out, and so the judge went ahead and ruled on the merits that had been pending for quite some time.
Justice Enoch, it's a nice story, but it is not true. Yeah. There are a couple of problems, even before one gets to the truth. I just want to tick them off. For one thing, even if notice was delayed, that can't justify jumping the gun and entering a judgment, because the fundamental principle of no adjudication without notice, even if you have a chance to opt out, like the principle of no taxation without representation, even if you can get a refund, is not a reward for good behavior in the course of litigation. It's an axiom of our system of government. But the fact is that this premise of Bally's tardiness is just made up. Notice-related discovery was judicially stayed pending review of the certification decision until September 97, and pending review of the refusal to decertify, again, from December 98. There's a 14-month window. In the first 3 months of that 14-month window, Bally produced, in exactly the form requested, something like 460,000 names, addresses, and payment histories by January 1998. They sat on those until September, until 2 days after summary judgment. Why? What was wrong with the 400,000-some-odd? You know what was wrong? They made it very clear, and it's in the brief. That's not what they wanted. They wanted to know the subset of those who were overcharged. And indeed, in the order of certification, they defined the class in terms of those who were charged more than the Texas law allows. This court has unanimously, in Intratex, condemned that as a fail-safe class. But in this case, unlike Intratex, you can't solve the problem, it seems to me, by decertifying simply to rewrite the definition, because in this case there's already been a judgment. But to answer your question, Justice Enoch, it was not any delay on Bally's part that caused that problem. They, from January, when they had all the names, until September 23rd, when they finally proposed their notice plan and specifically asked for an electronic version of the names so they could pin it down to those who were overcharged, which they surely don't have a right to do under the anti-fail-safe principle, sat on those names and did absolutely nothing because they didn't yet have their ironclad guarantee that they would only be sending out notice to those who were certified winners.
Before you sit down, let me go back over one more point just to help me understand. As you know, under the statute that our hands are tied by, there are only two ways in which the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction. One is with regard to a certification of a class. And you agree that what happened here was not a certification of a class.
Right. Nor in De Los Santos.
And there is not a refusal to certify.
Not literally, nor in De Los Santos.
Okay, so you agree that applying the strict interpretation of the statute, that the statute is not invoked.
Applying an interpretation stricter than De Los Santos, it's not invoked. But the whole point of De Los Santos, I think it's still good law, unless this court overrules it. The whole point was those words were not to be strictly construed. They were to be construed in terms of the sense of the situation. And in terms of the functions of the interlocutory review, this was essentially like certifying a new class, refusing to decertify this completely new creature.
Now, isn't your argument is based on the ruling on the summary judgment motion, correct? Isn't that the order being appealed from?
No, Your Honor.
Appealing as well from the two, the oral and the written motions that were denied on the request
decertification. That's all we're appealing from.
Well,
we're appealing from the combination.
All three of them?
No, we're not actually seeking a reversal of the summary judgment. This court wouldn't have jurisdiction to do that. We surely agree. We are saying part of the remedy that should ultimately be issued is to limit the summary judgment to the named parties as part of decertifying the class.
What is it you're asking the judgment to look like in this case?
That the class be decertified and that the class action be dismissed, but that the summary judgment, which if you read it on its face doesn't refer to the class, it was construed as applicable to the class by the Fourth Court of Appeal, but that judgment be allowed to remain.
But more specifically, I'm sure you're not saying that every refusal to decertify vests the Court of Appeals with jurisdiction.
Right.
What categories of refusal to decertify vest the Court of Appeals with jurisdiction?
A refusal to decertify that prevents a class from proceeding in violation of any category of Rule 42. That is, that takes a class out of Rule 42 altogether and therefore is not eligible for certification. That is, a refusal to decertify within the discretionary zone, within which judges are balancing things like predominance and superiority, is not of the sort of order that I'm talking about. I'm talking about a refusal to decertify, which in effect allows what was a lawful class under some category of Rule 42 to move into the zone of complete illegality under the precedents, both federal and state.
Counsel,
seems
you
to me
agree.
That's an easier case than De Los Santos.
You agree that this court doesn't have jurisdiction to look at the question of the certification. I mean, our jurisdiction at this point is limited to looking at whether or not the Court of Appeals had jurisdiction.
Chief Justice Phillips, in a way, but as I understand the decisions of this court in Bernal and other cases, saying that when you have jurisdiction under the conflict section of the statute, you have jurisdiction of the entire case.
Right, but are you saying we have jurisdiction under the conflict section?
Yes. I'm saying that you have jurisdiction under the conflict section because the decision below conflicted with De Los Santos, didn't simply misapply it, but conflicted with it because in a situation which was a fortiori, a change more fundamental than crossing the street from one kind of class to another, one that involves jumping over the chasm from a 42 class to one that is no longer authorized, that in that situation, to say that's not a fundamental change is to repudiate the core meaning of De Los Santos and its interpretation of these rules.
My problem is really related to Justice Abbott's question. It seems to me there has to be some areas where it's so clear on the face of the record what's been done that we can assert jurisdiction under De Los Santos. But we cannot get into factual resolutions in order to determine whether or not this class is, I guess what you would call an outlaw class that would confer jurisdiction on the Court of Appeals. And there are certainly instances, because they're cited throughout Respondent's brief, where a partial interlocutory summary judgment has been granted at some point in the proceedings before a class was finally certified and notice delivered, and that's okay for one reason or another. Either it's acquiesced in by a waiver. How far can this court get into examining what happened in this class before we violate the statutory scheme restricting, and I think wisely so, restricting the ability of two levels of appellate courts to micromanage what happens in the course of getting a case ready for trial?
Chief Justice Phillips, I think the easiest, maybe the best way for me to answer that is to relate it to Justice Enoch's question about who was dragging whose feet through discovery. If, in order to establish a facial case for the fact that we fit now the category of outlaw cases in which judgment preceded notice rather than the other way around, if in order to get there we had to persuade you that our electronic production was just top drawer and that we behaved wonderfully throughout this period, and if that was an indispensable part of our affirmative case, I think that there'd be a very good institutional reason for this court to say we can't go there. But all that stuff is here because of the attempts by the respondents to tell a tale of a different sort. They're in effect saying, if there is jurisdiction over the appeal, why then we ought to win because it was okay in this case to enter summary judgment before notice for the following reasons. It seems to me that the way this case is structured, they're the ones who are asking you to dig into those facts. We're not. That is, we are saying that on the face of it, knowing only the structure and sequence of the situation, this is the textbook case of one-way intervention that was flatly forbidden in 66 federally and in 77 in Texas. And that's all on the face of it. And all of their other arguments, including the argument about waiver, which I just want to say one word about, even though I see the red light and I still was hoping to have a rebuttal. But can I say one word about waiver? It's an amazing argument because, and it relates to a good bit here, it relates also to what Justice Hankinson asked about the defense that was made by Bally against Jackson. Jackson, in an earlier case, had been paid by a third party for the very claim he makes here. Bowie, therefore, wanted to say, whatever may be true of the class or of Mack or anybody else, we have this separate, unique defense against Jackson. Throughout the country, in every case that either side has cited to you, that doesn't amount to a waiver of protection against one-way intervention. But I want to add a point. To treat it as a waiver would be flatly unconstitutional. You know what it would be saying? It would be saying to you, if you have a unique defense against somebody, and if you dare to invoke our judicial system to assert it, then you give up the shield that you otherwise would have from piling on by others. That would violate the Petition Clause of the First Amendment, the Open Courts Clause of the Texas Constitution, due process clauses of both constitutions, and it would be an unconstitutional condition. There can plainly not have been a waiver.
Where would you draw the line on a trial court's ability to streamline class action litigation? Let's say you had a negligence claim, and the trial court ruled that there is a duty as a matter of law, and proximate cause remained to be decided. Would your argument be different in that situation?
I think not. I think I would say, as the advisors to the federal rules have said, and as other courts have said, it's a simple enough thing. It's going to be a class action, an opt-out class action. It's different if it's a mandatory one. It's going to be an opt-out class action, notifying the class, pinning down who they are, giving them a chance to opt in or opt out before you do anything on the merits of the case is the way to go. And that's a clean, bright line. As soon as you start messing with that line, oh, you can sort of do a little. You can. There are three issues. You can rule on one of them, but not two. I could easily see your point, Justice O'Neill, that that kind of line drawing is awfully tough for a court. But the bright line that the cases and the commentators have drawn, I think, ought to be maintained.
But how does that affect a trial court's ability? Texas has been pretty liberal in terms of allowing trial courts to work with the class, to modify it, to do different things. How would your rule affect the trial court's ability to do that? Pretty severely, wouldn't it? I mean, if discovery drags out, if notification drags out for years and years and years, you're saying the trial court can't really do anything to streamline the issues or streamline the...
I don't think so, Justice O'Neill. But as once there has been notice to the entire class and a chance to opt out, the trial judge, both on the merits, has plenty of flexibility. And the cases affirm some flexibility on possible class modification, subject to the fact that if it is a modification so drastic as to meet the De Los Santos test, there has to be an appellate look. But it seems to me that the far more sound institutional solution is to allow that flexibility to be exercised within a framework that says you do not give people a peek at one or another piece of the merits before you pin down who they are and give them a chance to say yes or no. I mean, if you're going to, you know, throw a pair of dice, you don't let people see one of the two before they bet.
But that's not what class actions are about, is it? I mean, a throw of the dice? Is it so that the members of the class have to take a risk as well? I mean, theoretically, what's wrong with letting them see that there is...
Because it's asymmetrical. What this court said in the Intratex and Ford cases was that it is not a legitimate purpose of Rule 42 to allow people to gerrymander fail-safe classes.
But
this one was a fail-safe class,
but
it's even worse.
That related to the definition of the class. This doesn't affect the class definition.
But it's worse because you can rewrite a definition. You can't rewrite history.
But this makes it hard. I mean, De Los Santos is at least easy in this way. The definition itself was changed. Therefore, it's kind of like a certification or refusal to certify. Here, it's another fact. An unrelated point has changed. There's been an order entered below that changes the attractiveness of it. It changes the calculus.
The legality.
How about
legality of it, Your Honor? How about changes the legality of it? In other words, I understand the appeal of saying that if it is not a change that you can see when you look at the certification order itself in the definition of the class, it's all over. But it seems to me that it would be...
Then it's not a matter of whether it's attractive or not. It's a matter of whether the legislature has said that an appellate court can intervene at this point in time.
But the legislature...
Isn't that what the issue finally comes down to?
Yes, but it depends, doesn't it, on what we mean by what the legislature has said. If you look at those words literally in the statute, they clearly do not cover changing from an opt-out to a mandatory class. So,
are you claiming that's what happened here?
Pardon?
Are you claiming that's what happened here?
No. I'm just saying it's what happened in De Los Santos. And what happened here was more extreme. And if De Los Santos is not to be overruled, I don't think it should be.
But you don't claim this became a mandatory class.
No, no.
I thought your brief said it.
Well, the brief, I think, spoke more loosely on that subject than I wish it had. It was not a mandatory class. Some people might still choose to be real gamblers, opt out, try to get their 17 times the amount that they get here, although finding a lawyer to represent them alone is not part of a class would be quite a challenge. Though the real point is, the fundamental change isn't that now you have to be certifiably insane to opt out. No, the fundamental change is that it's moved from one kind of class, namely one where both sides have something at risk, and where we're playing by the rules, to a totally different kind of class that is a class action in name. In that sense, Chief Justice Phillips, you're right. Nothing on the piece of paper has been changed. But surely the message of De Los Santos is that you could turn the paper over and look at what's really going on, not by digging deeply into ancillary facts, but by looking at facts of record that are intrinsic to the proceedings themselves, like a summary judgment on liability.
What would be your argument if the shoe were on the other foot? And that is that the class had been certified and the defendants moved for a partial summary judgment on one aspect of liability on an affirmative defense.
That would bind the whole class.
And you got a ruling in your favor.
I wouldn't have agreed to represent Valley in saying that was not interlocutorily appealable. I'm here because I think, quite symmetrically, that under fundamental principles and the statute that was construed in De Los Santos, there ought to be an opportunity for appellate review of that fundamental change, whether it comes from the defendant's side or the plaintiff's side. That is, the fundamental nature of the class could hardly be changed more than by having a ruling on a basic issue of liability bearing on the whole class before there's notice.
So your argument would be the same then if after class certification and prior to notification, you filed special exceptions, some of which were granted.
Special exceptions of what sort?
To the pleadings. I don't know if you use those in federal practice or not. Special exceptions would be you're specially accepting to the pleading, saying that allegations as stated, they don't state a cause of action with regard to this particular element, requesting that they replead and provide further, more detailed information.
Well, I guess I'd have to know more about the way the practice works, but I would draw a line between asking that someone clarify the pleadings and asking, in effect, for a ruling that something doesn't state a cause of action, which is a binding decision on the merits. If it's the latter, I would say it cannot proceed notice and an opportunity to opt out without fundamentally transforming the nature of the class and violating Rule 42.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Mr. Gary Snell, present argument from respondent.
May it please the court, it's certainly an honor to share the podium with an advocate of the stature of Professor Tribe. Even he, Your Honors, as great an advocate as he is, cannot transform an order declining to decertify the class into an order certifying the class and thus made appealable under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code.
Mr. Snell, Mr. Tribe said that because of our ruling in De Los Santos, that a court can now look beyond the words of the statute and take into account the circumstances in that particular case. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, I agree that De Los Santos allows the court to determine if an order is so profound as to create a new class, in effect, certify a new class. I think De Los Santos would require some change to the class, though, some change to the class definition, some change to the class certification order that is a fundamental change. De Los Santos, of course, went from opt-out to mandatory, and as to the 505 plaintiffs that weren't previously in the case, who are now suddenly in the case against their will and after the case had been tried, in a trial that they had not been allowed to participate in, certainly should be allowed the right to appeal. De Los Santos was quite correct. At least as to those people, a new class was certified in De Los Santos. When it went from...
Go ahead.
When De Los Santos went from opt-out to mandatory, all of a sudden 505 people who did not wish to be included in the class and strongly opposed being in the class were in the class against their will after the case had already been tried to a jury.
How do you respond to Professor Tribe's argument that I had sort of read the briefing to be that this had changed to a mandatory class, and I think Professor Tribe acknowledged that that is less than convincing than the argument that through the trial court's partial summary judgment, the class became illegal some way. Do you see that as a valid distinction?
Not at all, Your Honor. There is no absolute prohibition in state or federal law against some determination on the merits prior to certification or notice of classes. This has been done frequently in federal courts as well as the state courts. For example, the term one-way intervention does not even appear anywhere in Texas law before this case. You could do a Westlaw search of everything from 1890 on, and that term will not be found.
But let me go back. Presume with me that this is an illegal one-way intervention. I realize that's hotly contested and a much more complicated issue, but presuming that it is an illegal one-way intervention, would De Los Santos then apply?
No, Your Honor, it still has not changed in any way the class at all. The class definition and the class certification order, not a syllable, not a period of that order has been changed. Not a single person is in that wasn't in. No class member has one bit less right than that class member had before. The class members, if anything at all about this case is not to their liking, will be permitted to be opt out and not be affected in any way by this decision.
Do they have more rights?
Well, they have the right to have the benefit of the partial summary judgment if it holds up. Whether that's a right or not is, I think, debatable. It is not. We do not allow collateral estoppel or res judicata to apply to interlocutory summary judgments. It has to be a final judgment before anyone can have the right of claiming that it's res judicata or collateral estoppel. It certainly makes their decision more informed as to whether to stay in or not. They're benefited. Whether they got a right they didn't have before, I don't know. They certainly have not won the case. And if I can address that, the elements of proof in the case, Your Honor, will require six. Each class member will have to show that he has purchased a membership on credit. If he bought the cash, he's not there. He will have to show that he was charged monthly dues to be able to win this case. He will also have to prove that the particular dues that he or she was charged would not have been charged had he or she paid cash for the membership. That under the plan Bally's had in effect at the time and place that member joined, these dues would not have been paid. Now, this is the issue that has been decided, at least on an interlocutory basis. Under those circumstances, the dues are time price differential under Texas law. That's what partial summary judgment has decided, if anything, for the class. Still another element of proof, though, is that the dues, these dues plus the stated finance charges in the contract exceed the legal maximum.
Well, it seems to me that 1 through 3 are evidentiary matters. And I thought the trial court found on number 5, didn't the trial court say that the time price differential was illegal under our consumer statutes in the DTPA?
It found it to be time price differential, and I think that would be applicable to the class. Number 5, that the particular dues that Jackson and Matt paid plus the finance charges exceeded the legal maximum. Yes, ma'am, that was found only as to Jackson and Matt, not as to any other class member. The amount of dues and finance charges varies member by member.
So then really 1, 2, 3, and 5 are just elements of proof or evidentiary matters. They're not sort of elements of the cause of action.
Well, I think they are elements of the cause of action. I think in this case they present factual disputes, not legal disputes. I think the element that presents the legal dispute is whether under these circumstances it's time price differential.
What are the factual disputes?
Well,
about
the factual disputes, Your Honor,
I'm sorry. About 1, 2, 3, and 5. Their name, either they wrote a check or they didn't. Either they charged it to their credit or they didn't. Either their name's on the roll or it isn't.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can't you figure out 1, 2, 3, and 5 with a calculator in it?
You can.
It's records. Well, how's that in dispute?
Well, it remains to be done. Each class member will have to be proven to have done 1 through 5. And will have to show the amount of his or her damages. Bally certainly doesn't concede any of those matters, although I think perhaps they should. I think it won't be a great task or a great leap of faith to be able to prove those things.
Don't you think if you lose on 4, you've lost?
No, Your Honor.
Either side.
I beg your pardon?
Either side.
If you lose
whoever
on
wins
four,
or loses on four wins or loses the case.
Well, you can't win the case without winning on four. I'll put it that way. You can win four and still lose the case. If you don't prove five, if you don't prove six,
how can you not do it?
Well, Your Honor, if you take a particular class member and you take the dues he paid plus his finance charges, and they don't add up to more than the approximate 23% per annum the law allows, that member would lose. That person would lose.
But there would be others who win.
There would be others who won, assuming there are others who can get over the threshold of showing that the dues plus what is disclosed as finance charges reaches the level of being illegal.
And this could all be post-judgment. This is when they come in and just simply show the documentation and then they're given the check.
That's not my plan. I plan to prove that at trial through experts and accountants and records and so forth. I plan to prove it for every member at the trial of the case.
Now, put this, you filed this partial summary judgment motion. Put that motion in the context of the proceedings. Why was that motion filed at the time that it was filed?
Your Honor, in a desire to move the proceedings along and eliminate things that we thought were legal issues that should not be disputed and would not require numerous depositions, for example, if we establish that these dues are time price differential, then we need not go depose more Bally's executives about when and under what circumstances they're charged. And we, of course, summary judgments are the best way in the world to find out what the real defenses of a party are, because they tend to rise to the surface when a summary judgment is filed. All of those are tactical reasons that went into the decision to file a motion for partial summary judgment.
Before the notice was given.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Snell, do you agree that at some point the trial court could rule so far on the merits that the failure to have sent notice to the class creates a problem?
Yes, Your Honor, it could create a problem. Whether it would be error or reversible error or illegal is another question altogether.
Okay, so on that point, you're saying that what really is in question here is whether or not even a judgment where a class has been certified, the trial court renders judgment on the merits, but notice hasn't been sent. In those circumstances, it is unclear that would create such a fundamental change in an opt-out class that, in effect, it's a class certification reconsideration.
I would say not only is it unclear that it doesn't do it, I would say it clearly does not change the class and allow an interlocutory appeal to that order. The legislature has made a decision as to what will and will not be allowed to, where we will and will not be allowed to have interlocutory appeals.
So if this court would have to, but let me start with, this court has determined that a fail-safe class is not a permissible class. Is it possible for a class to be certified, the trial court to render judgment on the merits before notice goes out, that by that act of rendering judgment, before notice goes out, the trial court has in effect created a fail-safe class that wasn't as defined, but is as a practical matter because of the ruling on the merits?
Your Honor, perhaps I misunderstand fail-safe classes. I understood that term in this court's opinion to be classes that by definition don't exist if they lose. That if you don't win on the merits, you're not even in a class at all. That's what I thought a fail-safe class was.
But a fail-safe class could also be someone who's allowed to opt out if they determine that they would have lost on the merits in the class. So in other words, the trial court rules on the merits is against the class, and therefore the notice, and after that, the notice goes out, and therefore the members opt out of the class. Isn't that accomplished the same thing? Whereas I now know that if I stayed in the class, I would lose on the merits. I therefore choose to opt out. Isn't that tantamount to a fail-safe class?
Perhaps so, Your Honor. Perhaps that's why the federal cases that have considered this have said that where the defendant moves for summary judgment on the merits, the defendant accepts the risk that he will have a fail-safe class, as you define that term. The defendant accepts the risk that if I do this before the class is notified and I win, it may not bind the class, and the defendant waives the right to have any more than stare decisis protection against the class.
If the plaintiff moves for summary judgment before notice goes out to the plaintiff class, does the plaintiff accept the risk that they're creating a fail-safe class by the ruling of the court?
Well, yes, Your Honor. Obviously, there's that risk. We wouldn't be here if that risk didn't exist. And yes, the plaintiff accepts that risk when the plaintiff does that. Now, but does that make it appealable by interlocutory appeal? I think not, Your Honor. It has not changed. The plaintiff's motion for summary judgment has not changed one word of the class definition or in any way at all altered the rights of the members of the class, at least here, because the class members are free to opt out if they disagree with anything at all that was done. Summary judgments, the legislature has decided that there are occasions when summary judgments or the denial of summary judgments can be appealed. For example, when a member of the press seeks a summary judgment on grounds of free press or free speech and that's denied, the legislature's said you can appeal that. When a police officer, a governmental official, loses a summary judgment based on immunity, that loss of a summary judgment can be appealed. So the legislature has decided, obviously, that certain kinds of summary judgments can be appealed. They've not seen fit to extend that to summary judgments in class action litigation. Likewise, the legislature has decided that the failure to dissolve certain orders can be appealable. Orders appointing trustees receivers, a motion to dissolve that that's denied can be appealed. The Civil Practice and Remedies Code specifically allows that. But the legislature, for whatever reason, has not seen fit to. The plaintiff accepts that risk, and the plaintiff does that. Now, but does that make it appealable by interlocutory appeal? I think not, Your Honor. It has not changed. The plaintiff's motion for summary judgment has not changed one word of the class definition or in any way at all altered the rights of the members of the class, at least here, because the class members are free to opt out if they disagree with anything at all that was done. Summary judgments, the legislature has decided that there are occasions when summary judgments or the denial of summary judgments can be appealed. For example, when a member of the press seeks a summary judgment on grounds of free press or free speech and that's denied, the legislature said you can appeal that. When a police officer, a governmental official, loses a summary judgment based on immunity, that loss of a summary judgment can be appealed. So the legislature has decided, obviously, that certain kinds of summary judgments can be appealed. They've not seen fit to extend that to summary judgments in class action litigation. Likewise, the legislature has decided that the failure to dissolve certain orders can be appealable. Orders appointing trustees receivers, a motion to dissolve that that's denied can be appealed. The Civil Practice and Remedies Code specifically allows that. But the legislature, for whatever reason, has not seen fit to extend that right of appellate appeal to class actions. There's a policy arguments both ways on whether more appellate review of class actions should be allowed, but as this court has recognized, those policy arguments are more properly directed to the legislature.
The plaintiff can move for summary judgment on the essential merits of the case, as you've done in this case. The plaintiff can do that in a class action before sending notice. Why wouldn't he always do that?
Your Honor, I think it's a good thing for the plaintiff to do. I think it helps reduce issues in the case, and
if he wins, he's got a free ride, and if he loses, he doesn't have to send notice.
Well, I don't understand the loss of a summary judgment to have that effect. It's my understanding that if you lose a summary judgment, it just means that the court has declined at this time to dispose of the case on the merits and finds that there are tribal issues of fact that remain to be tried.
What tribal issues of fact are there on four?
I don't think there are any in this case, Judge, and I think that's why it was granted. But Bally certainly thought there were tribal issues of fact and raised in a response 2 feet high. Raise what they argued were tribal issues of fact.
Tribal issues, or they just disagree on the law?
No, Your Honor. They specifically and strenuously contended that this was a fact question, not a legal question, under the circumstances of the case. My point is, had they won on that, that wouldn't have done any harm to the class. It just means that we didn't get our summary judgment. It doesn't prove the negative. That would not establish that dues are not time price differential. Well, it would be just a declination or failure of the court to declare that they were.
Had they won, class representatives would have to think long and hard about putting the bill for notice to the class members if they know they're going to lose the case, or they think they're going to lose the case. Why would you do that?
Well, Your Honor, all I can say is I was certainly personally prepared to go right ahead and do that, and that's the obligation you undertake when you represent the class. If you try to get a summary judgment and you fail, that wouldn't change the class representative's obligations under the certification order to issue notice. It wouldn't relieve him of that obligation at all. And That's an obligation he or his counsel accepted when he undertook the case.
So you think if the plaintiff moved for summary judgment on the central legal issue in the case and lost on a question of law, that plaintiffs and their representatives and their class counsel would just go right ahead and spend millions of dollars sending notice to the class members?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if the plaintiff felt enough about the case at all to bring it, he would not be deterred by the fact that one particular...
He was going to lose.
Well, that one particular district judge declined to grant summary judgment. We all know that summary judgments can be hard to come by. The denial of a summary judgment is never appealable. It can't even be reviewed at all on appeal, whereas the granting of summary judgment can and often is appealed and has sometimes high fatality rates. So the loss of a summary judgment is not any sort of a fatal blow to anyone's case, in my opinion, at least in most circumstances. It just means that you have to come back another day and win in front of a jury or with better proof or with more than you had the first time you tried. But that's why I think we allow numerous or repeated motions for summary judgment. No, we're not restricted to one motion for summary judgment. Many things can happen with or without a suit, even though this summary judgment has been granted. The judge that granted it has an opponent, is in a heated election, may not be with us after January. As we know from De Los Santos, sometimes a change in the judges can change pretrial orders. Many things can happen to this order. So this case is by no means won, and the class is by no means free from risk even now. Obviously, we're at considerable risk by the fact that we're here right now, yet I'm ready, willing, and able to send the notice within a couple of days of when this court will allow me to do so. So that should not deter an advocate who is serious about his cause, the loss of a summary judgment. We don't want to get to the merits of this case because that's not before the court. It's only the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals. But I do hope the court will keep in mind that there is not a single federal case anywhere out of the thousands of federal cases that has decertified a class because of a partial summary judgment ruling for a plaintiff. There's not a single case that has done that. Only one case has decertified a class for a plaintiff who won, who did not seek certification prior to trying the case to a jury. That's Parrots versus Liberty Loan. That's the only federal case Bally's has found where a plaintiff got a favorable ruling on the merits and had his case decertified as a result. One case out of thousands and thousands, and that was after the plaintiff had a full jury trial on the merits before even asking for certification. And even in that case, the Fifth Circuit said, we are not holding here that there can never be pre-certification determinations on the merits. In fact, courts frequently do that. This court did it in GM versus Brewer by striking certain of the plaintiff's claims by summary judgment prior to certification. It's not an unusual circumstance. The Posto case cited in our brief is a federal case that specifically allowed a federal class action to go ahead where the plaintiff had gotten a summary judgment prior to notice of certification. And that case allowed it to go ahead after. So at most, federal law is unclear on this. There's certainly no absolute prohibition in federal law and no mention whatsoever in state law of any prohibition against a trial judge making some preliminary ruling prior to notification of the class. None whatsoever. Furthermore, as Professor Newberg points out, the whole purpose behind barring one-way intervention under Rule 23 has become academic because of the evolution of collateral estoppel, so that now it's no longer necessary to have mutual parties in the case for there to be collateral estoppel, the very underpinnings of Rule 23's prohibition against one-way intervention have been called into question by this development. So we're dealing with a situation where the federal law is unclear. We should respect the discretion you have always afforded trial judges in making these kinds of decisions on the timing of notice and the class action management of the class action.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Professor Trapp, could you respond to the last statement that was just made, that the jurisprudence of collateral estoppel has sort of undermined the underpinnings of one-way intervention?
Certainly. The the claim has been made by one or two commentators, but it was most eloquently and eruditely refuted by Judge Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit in Premier Electrical in 1987, which he carefully shows that it's not true and that there would be no authority constitutionally for the courts to undermine a rule which has the effect of a statute. Rule 42 here, just like Rule 23 in the federal system, has the effect of a statute. Non-mutual offensive collateral estoppel would, in fact, have been an illegitimate development in Juan Vuitton and then in Park Lane Hosiery if it hadn't been shot through with exceptions. Exceptions that from the very beginning in the Park Lane opinion were designed to say it won't apply if there was an opportunity to take part in the case in the first place. It won't apply. It's unfair to the defendant. Judge Easterbrook said the paradigmatic case where it's unfair to the defendant is the case where, as he colorfully put it, you would be pecked to death by ducks. Namely, you would lose one of these rather small skirmishes to one individual with very little at stake. In this very case, all that's involved is $400, I think. And then waiting in the wings would be a flood of ducks, as many as the bats under that bridge last night, that would all be swarming out there, armed with offensive, and it would be offensive, collateral estoppel. One-way intervention is just like that, and it's simply not true in the case law that it has been obliterated by the developments of collateral estoppel, and it's not true that there is just one case that supports the proposition that you can't have this sequence, not only in Harris in the Seventh Circuit, but just from the briefs, Gert v. Elgin in the Seventh Circuit.
Well, my understanding of the statement was that no court had decertified.
Well, sometimes
not that they hadn't said it was improper,
right.
But they
sometimes
hadn't.
What the courts do is limit the judgment to the parties and order dismissal of the case. They don't use the phrase decertified. That's how Mr. Snell comes to that conclusion, because I count 18 or 19 leading cases, some of them from lower courts in Texas, where functionally that's exactly what
now,
happened.
Now, is this a judgment rendered before certification or a judgment rendered before notice?
Before notice. Sometimes also before certification, but the courts draw no distinction. That is, even if the class has been certified, as long as the class hasn't been formally notified and given a chance to decide whether to opt in or out, the theory of all these cases is it's fundamentally improper to resolve the merits.
And
it's also not true, by the way, that a summary judgment denial is just nothing. It depends what it's based on. As Justice Heck pointed out, in this case, though, there were also factual disputes. The basic dispute between us, when you strip away all the rest, is whether in this special circumstance the $5 a month monthly charge, even though it is not directly correlated to the amount owed, amounts to a finance charge.
Well, and you claimed that that was a fact-intensive inquiry, correct? And by doing so, if the summary judgment had been denied, it wouldn't have been any sort of determination one way or other on the merits. It just would have been a recognition by the trial court that it was what you urged it to be, which was a fact inquiry.
It would depend, Justice O'Neill, what the trial judge wrote. If the trial judge said that the key point, not in dispute, is that the $5 a month memberships are not tied to the amount owed, and that sometimes they are waived because you pay the entire membership fee up front, and sometimes they're waived because it's the holiday season, and as long as that is the case, and that wasn't in dispute, it can't be, within the meaning of the Texas Credit Code, a time-price differential. If that ruling of law had been rendered, then we'd be exactly where Justice Heck posited for Mr. Snell. Namely, that's a dead loss. And at that point, it's remarkable that he now says, well, he spent the millions.
That's not what happened in this case.
No, of course not, Your Honor. But
as Justice O'Neill says, the position that Bailey took was that this was a factually intensive issue, and that fact issues existed which precluded the trial judge from ruling as a matter of law that the dues were a time-price differential.
Just
the denial of that motion left no determination as to the question of
just
law.
Just a second,
is that correct?
It's correct, but I don't know of any case in which one doesn't say, as a matter of law, you're wrong. And even if you don't agree with us on that, there are some facts you're assuming that aren't true. That's what happened here.
Unless you have competing summary judgment motions in which the court is asked to resolve a legal question one way or the other, which is not what happened here.
It is not what happened here, but I have to say it's not what happened here, But the institutional decision this court has to reach is not only about this case. It's about whether this practice should be allowed, or whether one should say under De Los Santos that this is a fundamental change in the class. In De Los Santos, by the way, I just reread the opinion back there. It's no great feat. It's just two pages. In De Los Santos, the court didn't say that because moving it to a mandatory class is a new class certification, we fit the statute. It didn't say that. It said it's a fundamental change.
Because, but that's, you've abandoned that argument. You're no longer saying this is a mandatory class.
Well, but the point is that the category of what is a fundamental change, we're suggesting, ought not to exclude moving to an illegal class.
But the court said more than that, didn't it? I mean, it basically went into the details of why this was a cram-down settlement. It deprived someone of their day in court. It created conflicts among counsel. It was much more than...
And I would submit you would have an easy time writing an equally detailed opinion of what a radical transformation this is, adding to the rights of some members of the class, subtracting from the rights of the defendant, a fundamental change.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument. In the first clause, the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.